Welcome to City Talks, a monthly podcast looking at the big issues facing UK cities and the latest thinking on urban policy. I'm your host, Andrew Carter, from the think tank Centre for Cities. I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to this edition of City Talks. Today, my guest is Debbie Weeks-Bernard. Debbie is Deputy Mayor of London with a focus on social integration, social mobility and community engagement, a position she's held since 2018. And prior to that, Debbie's worked for the Joseph Rowntree Foundation, the Runnymede Trust, amongst many other roles and positions. Welcome, Debbie, welcome to City Talks.
Nice to be here.
So we're going to focus on issues around race and ethnicity and policy making and impact in London. But just to kick us off, can you just say a little bit about, I suppose, what your role as deputy mayor for these kind of issues entails? I mean, it sounds like quite a big job. I mean, it covers, you know, a great number of very, very big issues. So just give us a sense as to what that role entails, and then we'll get into the detail of some of the issues.
Sure. So I think essentially, because the focus of my remit is on tackling inequalities broadly, so all of the equalities that are covered by the Equality Act, for example, as well as those which exist outside of it. So looking at making sure we can create a better way of life for those on low incomes, migrants, young carers, those from the care system. Because of all of those sort of broad areas, a lot of the work tends to be quite cross-cutting. So working with lots of other deputy mayors across City Hall to ensure that their policy making doesn't adversely affect any particular groups. But then also I do have some key responsibilities which are not cross-cutting. So for example, I have responsibility for grassroots sport, for example, because that helps to promote health and well-being, feeds into social prescribing, but also tackles issues like trying to bring people from different backgrounds together in the enjoyment of sport, and also for volunteering. So I have responsibility for all the volunteering across London. So there's the cross-cutting elements, and there are specific bits that that sit within the remit. But the remit is pretty big, yes.
And is it? I mean, is there a team that you are responsible for, or are you essentially, you know, influencing, as you say, across different aspects of the institution?
Yeah, so I have a number of teams. I have an equality and fairness team who deal with all of the inequalities type work, and they also help me to oversee the. We have an equality, diversity, and inclusion advisory group, and they're taken from all different parts of London. Lots of people who work in different sectors who've got responsibility for different equality strands, for example. I also have a social integration team, which is about some of that work I talked about, bringing people together and addressing some of those barriers to interaction between different groups. And I also have Team London, who oversee all our volunteering. I have a sports team who do all the community sports work. And I also have a community engagement team, importantly, because whilst all the different deputy mayors and all the different sectors across City Hall have, to a certain degree, an element of engagement with communities, we hold the sort of the levels of expertise about how to properly engage different communities across the city. So yeah, I do get teams, but then I do also sit in on lots of meetings with lots of them.
Yeah, trying to influence everyone else, but you know, in terms of what they're doing. No, so is that sort of classic between, you know, interventions of your own type as well, or what's directly in your control. Yeah. And as well as trying to influence in what's in the control of others and the various means by which you do that. Has the role and the need for it become more prominent? I mean, you have been in post since 2018, obviously, you know, very recently, which we'll get on to. We've had, you know, implications and issues associated with COVID and the Black Lives Matter movement. But even preceding that, I mean, you've been in post since 18. Is that when we've really kind of gained a bit of traction within, I suppose, within the GLA? What's your sort of reading of the history of these sorts of issues?
So you're completely right. I think 2020 has really seen a bit of an explosion of the need for a lot of the work that I certainly focus on. But even prior to that, I think the issue around improving community voices, and it's an ongoing, persistent issue that we need to get right and make sure that we're doing all we can to be both transparent but also bring people into City Hall. And also just the issue with high rates of unemployment in certain groups, which tend to relate to different ethnic groups, for example, different faith groups, and also the high rates of child poverty that exist in the city. So these are things which have always been an issue, I think, in London. And so I think the role of the deputy mayor has changed, I think. I think initially there was a bit of a real focus on the integration element and bringing different people together. But then we also began to realise, you know, that people have differences of opinion, etc., by virtue of their income and by virtue of their migration status and all of those things. And then those things individually have a range of other issues which relate to them. So the role has changed. And I think, yeah, this year has certainly seen a lot of the things that we've been talking about for a long time actually be talked about as a sort of national policy level, which has been great to see. It's definitely been one of those years, I think.
Okay, so you started to touch on it there. So just how do you frame the challenges or the issues that you're trying to, you know, address? I mean, how do you conceptualize them? How do you provide a framework for them? I mean, in a sense, you know, be interested in your questions and issues about whether there's a sort of representation sort of element to the nature of the challenge that we see when we think about race and ethnicity. Is there a sort of treatment? We know that, you know, the data tells us quite clearly that there seems to be a treatment problem in different services. And then obviously there's an impact and outcomes and the changes that we would want. But I mean, how would you frame the nature of the problem so we can, I suppose, disaggregate it and then try to do something about it?
I think one of the things that's always been quite important to me has been the nature of the evidence. So I do have a research background, and so I've always been quite keen on using the data to try to influence, but also to better understand how something is impacting on a particular set of individuals. So I think for the large part, we do want to be led by the evidence. The evidence is helpful. So for example, if we look at unemployment rates here in London, for young Black men in particular, they're very high here. Yeah. And they impact on that group in a different way than it would do in other parts of the UK, which is really interesting. Some of that may have something to do with, you know, the high numbers of young Black men who are living in the city. But also, I think there's a lot to do with the sorts of roles that they're interested in going for, the sectors that are available for them to work in. And so we've used the data to try to develop something which is very specific and targeted for that group of individuals. And that has been really helpful. And so using data is really good. And I think we should try to be as evidence-driven as possible. And we've also, last year, we launched something called the Survey of Londoners, which was our attempt to try to measure social integration. And social integration is one of those things which people describe as being quite fluffy because they think it's about holding hands and just getting on.
Being nice to each other, right? Yeah. Just saying hello when you walk past each other in the street seems to be, you know, I've done my bit for the day. I feel socially integrated. I can move on. And, you know, everything else takes care of it. I know what you mean.
Exactly. So we set out to measure it because we recognize that integration is about more than just that. And so we've got an evidence base, and that's actually been really helpful because it helps us to understand how people experience the city. And if we know how different people are experiencing the city, we can make sure that our interventions and our policies are more targeted. One of the things that I think is incredibly important is that if the evidence is screaming at you and saying that there is a gap or an inequality or an issue, then you should use what resources that you have to try to address that. And if that does mean doing something which is targeted rather than universal, then so be it. I think one of the things that we've kind of maybe struggled with a little bit in this country has been that when it comes to race and ethnicity specifically, there's been a bit of a sort of, if we take a universalist approach to policy making, then by virtue of that work, we should be able to influence and help minority ethnic groups, but that hasn't happened. And so I think it's really important for us to use the data at our disposal and also to use what we know has not been happening or working for the past however many years and do something a bit more focused and a bit more targeted, and use that as a way to try to make the difference that we know hasn't been happening.
That's a great point. I mean, just going back to your, I haven't looked at the survey, but in the survey and of London, what's your sense that there is a kind of general awareness amongst, you know, all of London, as it were, or all of the survey, that, you know, these are issues that are prominent and they need to be dealt with? Or do we actually see that the awareness itself is also kind of localized into certain, you know, certain ethnicities, or, you know, certain income brackets, or what? I mean, what's your sense of the data around that?
I think it's the latter. I think there is an awareness if it's something that's impacting on you specifically, but I think across the board there hasn't been that awareness. So if you're not in a particular group, you won't necessarily recognize that there is something which is impacting on that group in a different way to the way that you're experiencing it. And I think if I'm honest, I know we might talk about this and touch on it later, but Black Lives Matter certainly has really kind of opened up lots of people's eyes to the way that discrimination has impacted upon particular groups, Black people in particular, in a way that they may not necessarily have realized. And also, I think during this lockdown, there have been lots of people who have become aware of the way that different policies impact on different groups. So the no recourse to public funds issue, for example, the way that restricts the ability of migrants to avail themselves of different services that everyone else has access to. Lots of people just didn't know that was a thing. So I think with the survey, yes. It gave us an insight into people's lives, which is great, but the crossover between different groups still necessarily isn't there. So not everyone knows how everyone else is experiencing our city, which is a shame, but it helps us to know what we need to do to try to improve that.
And is the survey, is there a sort of time series to the survey? So have we seen any change over time for good or for, you know, good or for ill?
It was a snapshot, right. Definitely. And we're hoping to try to do it again. But it was a fairly big survey. It was all of Londoners. So it was a representative sample, so around 6,000 people. One of the things that it helped us to do was it was the first measure ever of food poverty in London. And it was something that I know the Food Foundation were really grateful to us, because it was, I think there's quite a few things that we don't have enough data on, and food poverty was one of them, and it helped us to understand how many people in London are actually just living without proper access to food. And the thing that's I mean, I know we're having a conversation about London, but the whole sort of discourse around levelling up is really interesting, because yes. If you see how many people are actually living in poverty here in London, how many people don't have access to healthy food. I think during the pandemic we saw that the numbers of children who are experiencing malnutrition have doubled just during the period of the lockdown. And these are things that, you know, ordinarily people wouldn't think would happen, but our wealth gaps are enormous. So yeah. I think we do need to try to understand more just how difficult some people are experiencing London and experiencing life, and that cuts across income but also cuts across ethnicity, migration status, the whole lot.
Well, and it talks to a sort of, you know, which you see a lot in policy about the, you know, on the one hand, you know, there's a need to kind of aggregate the situation so we can understand that, you know, big movements and big trends. But actually, as we know, particularly but not exclusively, if you aggregate to the London scale, you see a picture of a reasonably successful, you know, city that outperforms many other places on a whole range of different indicators. Yeah. But as you say, what that misses, and actually where policy really needs to get into, is to disaggregate then from the aggregated picture to understand the nuances and the variety of different experiences and different outcomes, so we can actually begin to target policy into those sorts of areas, I think.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that the whole conversation around COVID has maybe helped us to think about that a bit more in different ways. I mean, COVID itself, the way in which the pandemic has been impacting on different parts of the UK has enabled us to sort of do those sort of regional snapshots in a way that it's good and it's important for us to do, but then when you do so, you recognize that there are all sorts of other drivers of different things which are important. So if we look at what's been happening in different parts of the Northeast in relation to certain communities, and the fact that prior to the pandemic, lots of people were saying that there were health inequalities which were impacting upon particular minority ethnic groups, the Black, Asian and minority ethnic groups, which were driven by income, by driven by where they lived, the type of housing, the quality of the housing, and also the sorts of work, the sorts of jobs that they were able to get and work in, and that those are the sorts of things which drive health inequalities, which COVID just amplified, really, which really kind of influenced that disproportionate impact of COVID on so many Black and Asian and minority ethnic groups in the UK.
Yeah, you touched on it a little bit when you were sort of saying about the nature of the job, but just to explore that a little bit more, can you just say a little bit about, you know, how you introduce the racial and the ethnic kind of elements into the devolved decision making process? I mean, you talked about the data and the evidence, which is the sort of aggregation, I suppose, but you also mentioned, you know, community engagement, you know, involving the individual and or the group or the place. But just say a little bit around how you actually, you know, that gets fed in. And I suppose then the obvious next question is, how would we, you know, what's done differently, or what, you know, what is on the process side or on the decision-making side as a result of that kind of intervention or that engagement?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I think, so community engagement is really key to getting some of those issues around race and ethnicity into decision-making, but into the devolved decision-making in particular. And I mean, so before I became the deputy mayor, I didn't work very much with the GLA at all. And I mean, that obviously speaks to the fact that I was working for the Joseph Rowntree Foundation. So most of my work was in the Northeast, fair enough. But even when I worked for the Runnymede Trust, there wasn't that much engagement or work that I did with the GLA, even though I knew about them and knew what they were doing. And I think what we are getting better at doing is, making ourselves more transparent to London and bringing voices in order to influence the way that we do policy making. There's a couple of ways that we've tried to do it. So for example, and this is not in my area, but in housing, we've got the London Housing Panel, which is run in conjunction with Trust for London. It's an initiative which brings the voluntary sector into a space with the Mayor of London, with the GLA, with Trust for London, with other funders, so that they can influence our housing strategy. And obviously housing is it's a responsibility that, you know, the mayor has, and so it gives Londoners a direct line into how we think about how to improve housing for Londoners. And it's great, and I think that's a really good way of involving Londoners. What we also do, and what my teams do a lot of work on and with, is working with civil society. A lot of the initiatives that we develop, we couldn't really do unless we had like a really strong and thriving third sector to work with. And I think, the third sector is one of these sectors, I used to work in it myself, but it's a sector which does really important and incredible work, often very thankless and doesn't get the recognition. But certainly I think during austerity and certainly during this pandemic, there's been a lot of demand for the third sector to sort of step up and do a lot of that work with communities. And so we work with civil society and third sector organisations to help us to engage with Londoners. Because, you know, if we're completely honest, Londoners have a lot more trust and faith in those services that they engage with routinely, with those voluntary sector or community centres or whatever it is in their local area, than they would do with City Hall, because they engage with them more frequently. And so we work with the third sector and work with them as a bridge builder to enable us to reach and engage with Londoners, which is important. And that is the way that we try to get their voices into what we do. But also we have to work with the third sector to get their voices into what we do, because the third sector does such great and amazing work, but they're stretched financially. So we are a big, we're quite a big grant giver at the GLA. So we do provide a lot of financial resources where we can to the third sector in conjunction with local authorities. Local authorities also are big funders of local third sector organisations. But I, you know, we have to recognise that we've got a recession coming. And local authority budgets will be stretched, and so there are ways that we are trying to work together to try to make sure that we can continue to support our third sector.
And when you bring those sort of voices and perspectives to the table, I suppose, Debbie, what, maybe this is a slightly unfair question, but what's the biggest thing that, you know, the policy making process gets wrong, you know, as a result or before these kind, you know, in a sense, what is the change or the impact that these voices have on the policy making process, and you know, that we may miss if we didn't do it that way?
I think it's authenticity is one, but also that real lived experience of a policy on the ground. If we don't talk to Londoners and if we don't talk to the third sector, we'll never know how our policies are impacting on their lives. So we have to talk to them. But the thing that I don't want us to do, and what I've hoped that our community engagement teams have been able to do, is to not just kind of go to communities as though we've got finished projects and just say, what do you think? Do you like it? We're getting better at co-creation. And co-creation isn't easy. You know, if you want to do it properly, that means working with communities and individuals who may not necessarily have been exposed to the way in which devolved policy making works or regional policy making works. But that's the best way to try to ensure that your policy making is properly informed. And that means going to people before you've kind of finalized what it is that you're trying to do. I think if we don't, particularly on race and ethnicity, if I'm honest, and as well as all the other equality issues, if we don't go to groups to talk to them about housing, regen, policing, education, then those policies will miss them out and they won't impact on them in the way that we want them to impact, to be impacted. And also, we need people to feel like they've had a say, and that this is something that they are part of, rather than being done to constantly.
Yeah, no, quite. Because it's an interesting, you know, and you perfectly touched on it, which is, you know, there are questions about how policy or decisions get made, and that's an important thing we should focus on, and that is related but slightly different from the decision that ultimately is made. Yeah. You might be making the right decisions, you know, because like yourself, you know what you're, you know, you come from, you know, a deep understanding of the issues, and you still might come to the right decision, as it were, in, you know, right inverted commas, but actually the process by which you arrive at that is as important as, in some respects, the outcome at the other end.
Absolutely. I completely agree.
That's a very good point. Let's move on to, because you touched, let's take them in turn. And I just wanted to get your thoughts on, I mean, we talked about them right at the beginning, but give us a sense as to how kind of Black Lives Matter has, you know, changed the situation, both in terms of, you know, in a broader sense, you know, about London more generally, you know, how you think it's permeated through the consciousness of London in all its different guises, and then I suppose how the GLA has sort of internalized, you know, the movement, and you know, what the demands of the movement, and what, you know, what you think some of the effects are going to be about the way that GLA functions or operates and the decisions it makes. So just your big thoughts on that.
Yeah, no, that's really important. So I think with the death of George Floyd really did expose in America clearly the issue of structural racism, issues of police brutality, but also brought to the fore the ways in which Black Americans daily have an experience of racism with those who have power over them. So it's the police, but also the labour market, all sorts of areas. And I think it was inevitable that there was going to be a global outpouring of support in relation to that. I think a lot of us were surprised about how much and how quickly that global support manifested itself. But here in London, certainly the mayor, so Sadiq Khan, he made it really clear that he was supportive of the right to protest, but also made a couple of really important statements initially about recognizing just what structural racism looks like and feels like and how important it is for us to all play our role in addressing it. But he also made some really important points about the sort of distinguishing between different ethnicities. And so the use of the word BAME, for example, which is something that I know that Black Lives Matter, but also lots of people who've been talking about the issue have said, it's a problematic term because it lumps everyone together and doesn't recognize we all have different ways of experiencing the world. And he himself said that he recognizes that as a mayor who is Muslim, his experience of the world is different to those who are Black, and that's important to make that distinction. And so, you know, at City Hall, I think the things that we were keen to do were to use this as a really good moment to just enhance and amplify a lot of the work that we have already been doing in the sort of space of supporting Black communities. So we've been doing a lot of work on that already. And it gave us the opportunity to really shout about it, which was great. So we announced the Commission on the Diversity in the Public Realm, which is a really important way of looking at how different groups are memorialized or are not in our city. And that's something which we'll actually be, I think, announcing this week, an open call. We're going to recruit 15 commissioners who are going to help us to think about how we look at London, how we look at our street names, how we look at our statues. They're very Victorian, they're very male. They don't represent not just those from different ethnic backgrounds, but also women, also those from the working classes, also those from LGBTQ plus backgrounds. And just, you know, let's see if we can use this moment to change that conversation. And we also, because there was a huge outpouring of feeling clearly on the streets in terms of those protests about the relationships between Black communities and the police, we have been working on an action plan with the Met. So the GLA and MOPAC, so myself and the Deputy Mayor for Policing, have been in ongoing conversations with the Metropolitan Police, but also we've run loads and loads of workshops with different community organisations and individuals to see what we can do to make some proper changes around the way in which people have daily interactions with the police, which do not improve their trust in that service. And that's been difficult. We've had some really difficult and challenging conversations. The mayor held a fairly large meeting on the 5th of June with a lot of community organizations and human rights groups, etc. And it was visceral and it was raw and it was incredibly emotional. But, you know, that is as it should be, because people have things to say that they've been saying for a long time.
Yeah.
This is a moment in which everyone is listening. I mean, I've got to say, seeing the BBC have conversations about race first thing in the morning was an amazing thing to behold. I don't think I've ever seen that before. And I've worked on race equality for a very long time. And so I really can see that there is a real tangible difference in the way that we're talking about race, which is important. And what I don't want to happen is for this to fall off the news agenda and for everyone to just move on to the next thing and to not take any of these issues to their logical conclusion, to keep on talking about them and to keep on fighting for them. So,
it's interesting you touched on that. I mean, when you're engaging with, you know, the different groups and different communities, I mean, if you think about the kind of police and crime domain, you know, I mean, is that the thing that essentially dominates to a large extent the sort of the concern? I'm not saying there are many other concerns as well, but in a sense, you know, is that really the sort of fulcrum of the issue and the, you know, the worries and the concerns and the frustrations and the anger, in a sense, you know? And then again, this is very crude, but if we could make improvement in that area, you know, that's such a significant area of concern that, you know, you would be dealing with, yes, it's only one domain, but you're actually dealing with a very large chunk of the concerns. Is that right or not?
I think it's right. I think that because the focus is on what happened to George Floyd in that moment, and that was about policing, that has made the conversation about policing in the UK an issue, definitely. Right. And yes, if we can make some differences in relation to that, that would be amazing and important. But it doesn't, I suppose, take away from the fact that we're talking about broader structures.
Yes.
We'd have to also talk about the labour market and where people are employed. And we'd have to talk about the education system and the way in which some groups continuously are unable to really reach their potential at different points in their educational careers. We could talk about the health system as well. I think COVID has obviously presented itself as, you know, we have had some real difficulties with people not feeling that they are able to access health services because those health services are not receptive to them. So people not going to hospital, even though we know that this is across the whole board in relation to COVID, but people not going to hospital when they feel ill because they don't speak English as their English is not their first language. So they won't be able to tell the person caring for them how they feel, what their experiences are, what their symptoms are, etc. And then feeling very uncomfortable and worried and anxious about that, not being able to, you know, going into hospital, not getting culturally appropriate food, all of that kind of stuff. So I think whilst the policing element is incredibly important, and it is important, let's be honest, it's what's driven all of this, we also have to recognise that there are structural racist issues occurring across a range of institutions.
I was just listening to you kind of list out all the issues, which I would agree with, but it just overwhelms, you know, in a sense, it overwhelms me as a, like, I agree with all of that, but how, you know, how do you, you know, is it a question of prioritisation, you know, in terms of making, you know, making quite a lot of ground on one, two, three things, or is it the sort of broad brush, making a little bit of movement on, you know, on a great many things? I'm not saying they're mutually exclusive, but, you know, just as a policy maker and, you know, kind of trying to move forward on these things. I mean, how do you manage that? How do you deal with that? How do you think about that?
That's so important. Yes, we could do it one at a time. The government has got a race commission that they've just established. So I would be hoping that they'd be thinking about some of this stuff. If they want to come and chat to me, that would be great. But yeah, you're right. As a policymaker, you do have to think about where you can make tangible differences. So we are doing some work on trying to address issues of trust with Black communities and the police, because we know this is preventing people from seeking help and support from a service that they don't have any trust, and that's leading to people losing their lives and not feeling protected, which is a massive problem. So we know that that's an issue and we are working on that currently, but at the same time we are already thinking about how we can also engage in relation to the health service and the education system. I think with COVID, because we're already doing quite a bit of work on the way that the pandemic sort of disproportionately impacted on certain groups, we're already in that sort of space already. There are things that we were already sort of doing in some areas. So for example, on education, we were doing quite a lot of work on trying to address the fact that you just don't see senior leaders who are Black in schools. You just don't. The number of head teachers who are Black, or indeed who are Asian, it's very, very small in the UK and certainly here in London. And so we've already been trying to do some work on that and trying to do some work working on the workforce issue. But we're also at the same time as doing sort of the action plan on policing, we're thinking of doing some work around decolonizing the London curriculum, which is really exciting. And it's about trying to do some of that work that Black Lives Matter protests raise, which is about saying we need to have a better conversation about race and about history for our young people. And then the realm stuff is about having a better conversation about race and history for everyone, regardless of age. So we can do things at the same time. this is why I'm so tired. we can do things at the same time.
Yeah.
And we can make those incremental changes where we can. And the mayor, so, I mean, obviously, there are certain powers that he has. So obviously, the work that we're doing with on policing is different to the work that we can do on education. We have no powers in the education space whatsoever.
Yeah.
We can do work on the London curriculum, working with senior leaders,
yes,
of London schools, but we cannot compel anyone to do anything. It is inviting people to work with us, and using the mayor's convening powers to try to get that better conversation on race where we can. So,
and that's an interesting point, because I mean, you know, we always talk about you know, the different powers and responsibilities that, let's say, the, you know, the mayor of London has, or the, you know, the metro mayors elsewhere have. And obviously talking about their hard powers and their soft powers, and, you know, convening and influence, and, you know, the ability to raise awareness or to be the person on the news are all on the kind of softer side. And whereas, as you say, issues around directly having influence over the police or indeed the transport system, etc., much more on the hard side. I mean, just in terms of the advancement of some of the things that you're trying to achieve, are there big gaps in the sort of in the powers of the mayor as currently set out that you would ideally, you know, you would ideally want? And I appreciate, you know, more money, you know, power over everything. I get that, right? I mean, I assume that would be the constant, you know, request, but so let's hold that as a constant. But are there specific things that you think, you know, having kind of more influence beyond the sort of soft element on X or Y, we think would make a material difference to what we could achieve?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. I mean, so if you think about the labour market, for example, and you think about the way that, so, you know, the way that COVID exposed those who are more at risk of contracting it were those in those frontline roles, those key worker roles. And these were the roles which are usually not very well paid. Progression is very limited, and they are very heavily occupied by people from Black, Asian and minority ethnic groups. So you would want to be able to have more powers in respect of how to work with businesses and compel businesses to employ people more equitably. But some of that is around skills. So we do have the adult education budget, which is brilliant, which is great. But then for me, for those who are on some of those lowest incomes, one of the things that I know would make a real huge difference would be to have a welfare system that really works, and we don't have that. We have no powers in that space. The mayor has done an awful lot to lobby, talking about making changes to universal credit, for example, bedroom tax, two-child limit, some of those things. If we were able to have more regional control over the way in which some of those policies were set, we could make a real difference to the lives of Londoners, because I know that that's one of the things which is really pushing people into poverty or stopping them from being able to get out of it, is having a welfare system that will help them to prop up their incomes. But you can't do these things in isolation. So doing that whilst also having work which pays well. So we do have, we've got the Good Work Standard, which is, it's like, you know, asking businesses to sign up to pay their employees at least the London Living Wage.
Yeah.
And that's stuff that we can do. But, you know, having more devolved powers in that space would be great. So those are things where I think devolved powers would make a huge difference. And obviously immigration is incredibly important. I think in London, certainly, the impact of immigration policy on Black and brown people in relation to no recourse to public funds has been incredibly difficult. It's increased the rates of destitution of far too many people of colour. And we certainly think that the immigration policy that we have currently just isn't working. It isn't fit for purpose. And so this is proper pie in the sky, but, you know, having some more control over the way that we can try to determine what it is that should be applied to people here in the city would make an enormous difference. But these are, you know, I can't make that decision.
Oh, of course. But I mean, those are the kind of things that, you know, reminding everyone, but certainly reminding national politicians and national policymakers that, as you said right at the start, and I've said throughout, you know, policies that are designed around the average, which is typically what happens, and you know, for understandable reasons, missed a whole lot of variation, whatever the variation, whether it's geographical variation or group variation or ethnic, you know, variation or, you know, color variation, all of those sorts of things, you know, they, and the danger is the more variation you get in places, you know, the more the policies sit uneasily, and you know, that results in, you know, very you know, imperfect outcomes, let me say it in that way.
Yeah.
I think that is a very very good point. This is a slightly unfair question, maybe, and it gets asked of me quite a lot, so it's nice to ask someone else it instead. But I mean, think about London, but think about it in a global context or international. I mean, how would you, you know, how does London fare on the issues that we've been discussing? You know, are we making progress? Are we, you know, are we doing good things? How do we, and then where do you look for inspiration or insight or experiences in other, you know, other places? We know that there are loads of, you know, city networks on different issues, environment or labor market or, you know, COVID responses that are global or certainly European. But I mean, where's your head in all of that? How would you, you know, that's the kind of classic question I get asked all the time, which is, you know, where's the best city in the country and how does it compare to everyone else in the world? And my mind immediately goes blank. So that's why I'm continuing to talk while you can process my question, which is deeply unfair, but you know, I thought I'd give it to you rather than, you know, getting it given to me all the time.
Gosh, that's so hard. I mean, obviously I would say that London is doing amazing things.
Yes, I mean, I would fully expect you to say that, of course.
Gosh, so that is really hard because if we think about social integration, for example, I know that I'm the only, well, prior to me taking on this role, I know that this is the first role that has been created in this way. Having a role that focuses specifically on social integration, just in other cities, that role doesn't exist.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, I'm going to say, obviously, that I think that London is leading the way in respect of that, and that's important. But then also it's slightly worrying because some of the issues that we are experiencing here in London are global issues, right? So, and if we think about the fact that London is a destination for lots of people from across the globe who are coming here in order to access a better way of life or standard of living.
Yeah.
What that suggests or tells me is that there are other cities that are, you know, across the world that are just not getting that stuff right. One of the things that I do worry about, though, and I was saying this to someone just the other day, when it comes to social integration, we've kind of talked about it as being about trying to make sure that everyone has equal access to a better standard of living, so people feel that they are part of their city, they feel more positive about their just about their lives, and they're more likely to feel able to interact with others on that basis. And so it's about getting their personal situation to a better place. Whereas elsewhere in other parts of the world, if I'm honest, when you talk about social integration, people think about terrorism. And so, and that's what's been interesting about that is that when I have had conversations with some other individuals about what social integration means, they often think that I'm talking about ways of preventing people from becoming radicalized, and that's not the way that we define it. I'm not answering your question at all because
but it's an interesting point around the way that they're big terms, right? I mean, this is where we started. And they said, you know, these are massive terms, and therefore they are open and they're open to interpretation across many different, and you see, as you've just described, in a sense that neither of those vision, you know, those versions are wrong, but they are different, right? I mean, they are different ways of thinking about and framing the problem, which then obviously manifests itself in decisions made or policies that are pursued because of the way that problems or issues or challenges get framed. I think that's such an incredibly important but often missed part of the policy process, which is how are we actually thinking about the problem?
Yes.
We worry about and get into what we might do about it, and you know, and the change that we are looking to, you know, we're looking to achieve.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I suppose, thinking about your question also, I think about it as an individual rather than as a policymaker. And I think about, you know, the places where I feel safe to travel. So when you think about holidays, which obviously I've not had a foreign holiday this year for obvious reasons. But when I do, one of the things that has always struck me has been that as much as I love to go to different places in Europe on holidays, I do love to return, because being in London, myself and my family are never stared at. And what I find really interesting about the fact that we are, you know, where we are in time, that you could go to a place and still have people stare at you as though you are exotic. And that does happen, not just, however, when I go abroad, but in some other parts of the UK.
Yeah.
And London definitely has always felt as though it's a place where if you come from a particular background, you feel safer, because they're not just that there are more of you, but just that people don't question your background in that way, whereas that happens elsewhere. And I don't want to make terrible assumptions, because, you know, it's not the same across all of London, and this is not the case across all of the UK or indeed across all of Europe, but it remains a fact that there are some ways in which we talk about race and ethnicity in other cities, absolutely, which are not the same way that we talk about them here.
Yeah, and that talks to you know, the idea of, and the that cities, and particularly our big international, you know, super connected, super diverse cities, which London is all of those, but there are many across the globe, you know, the role and significance, and indeed it's some of the responsibility that they have as cities to actually bring some of their, you know, maybe to bring their countries with them in some respects,
yeah,
in terms of being able to A, express and talk about these issues, and then obviously try to resolve them, or at least make them, you know, make them better than they currently are. And I think, you know, that, I mean, that's in a sense, you know, that the sort of cities lead the movement and draw others in, particularly, but not exclusively, you know, places such as London, which has had a more, you know, a richer, more diverse background. It's much more diverse than any other part of the country currently, one of the most diverse, you know, cities on the planet. And so, you know, there is a role there, right? I mean, I think, you know, I don't know what you think about that, but that's certainly, you know, something that we talk about and think about a lot, really.
Yeah, no, I think that's good. I think that's a really good point. I think cities having a responsibility to bring their countries along with them is a good point. And it's something that we strive to do in London. We do strive to, I mean, we do have conversations with other city mayors, and we do talk about the differences. We talk about, you know, trying to improve our access to devolved decision making all the time, but also we do share some of the experiences that we have, which are broadly similar in many of the big cities across the UK. But you are right, it shouldn't be the case that you have a city like London which almost feels as though it's so different to other parts of the country when it comes to issues like race and ethnicity. It should be the case that other parts of the country are also similar. And it shouldn't be the case that, you know, if you are Black or Asian or from a minority ethnic background, that you have to go through this entire process of thinking, well, I'm going to go to this other place outside of the city. What sort of experience am I likely to have? Do I need to prepare myself? And it's something that lots of people who come from minority ethnic backgrounds have to think about. And it's a shame that in 2020 that's the situation, but it is a fact. And I think that's why Black Lives Matter is so important, actually, because it forces us to have that conversation and forces us to sort of say, well, you know, am I not as welcoming as I could be? And if I'm not, what do I need to do to be to get better at welcoming people from everywhere, rather than only seeing things in or judging things by my own experience? So that's been really important, I think.
Yeah, and I suppose we could talk forever, but I mean, just in terms of just bringing to a close, I mean, you talked there about and talked earlier on about, you know, the Black Lives Matter issue particularly, but also I think, you know, COVID and the way obviously COVID has has played out, not only in London, but, you know, across the country, you know, a kind of a step change in, I suppose, the awareness of the associated issues, and a step change in the discussion, you know, in the sense that feels like the discussions have gone from being on the sidelines to, you know, to being more mainstream, which I, you know, I think is genuine progress. But in terms of beyond that, in terms of actual change, or, you know, real change on the ground, I mean, what should we keep our eyes out for, Debbie, over the, you know, over the net? This isn't going to happen tomorrow, and it's not going to happen the day after. These are, you know, these are big issues that change slowly, but nevertheless, you know, we can make progress on them. I mean, you know, what should we be looking out for? How will we know that we're on the right track?
That's such a good, it's a really good question. I mean, so at the moment, we are trying to think about London's recovery as we come out of, well, I was about to say as we come out of lockdown, but I know we've had an announcement today, which suggests that we might be going back. But we do have to think about London's economic recovery and London's social recovery. And the things that I would want to see in relation to that are some of those improvements in relation to the labour market, certainly, and some of those changes in relation to people's incomes more broadly. And indeed about having a better conversation about race, definitely. But if we're thinking about those tangible things that we can try to achieve, we'd certainly want to see sort of better collaborative working in London between ourselves, between London boroughs, between a range of other significant partners in the city to make those tangible differences. And we've already started thinking about what that might look like. And for me, that means having in relation to race and ethnicity, closing some of those gaps for certainly for minority ethnic groups, but for young people in particular, because we know that when it comes to the lockdown, young people really were impacted by the shutdown of sectors. So some of the work that we started before the pandemic, we are hoping we can continue. We recognize there is a recession coming, but we've got work that we've been doing to try to get young Black men who we know have got those high unemployment rates that I've mentioned into growth sectors. So these were growth sectors before the pandemic, and we expect them to be growth sectors as we come
our
out.
Our fingers are crossed. For those that are listening, our fingers are crossed on Zoom, by the way. So you won't get that because you'll be listening, but just visualize Debbie and me just with our fingers crossed at each other.
fingers crossed for that growth sector. Yeah. Because, you know, we're just going to have to operate as though those sectors continue to have those areas of growth. So tech and construction, definitely. Two sectors which don't employ young Black men in huge numbers, but we know are growth sectors generally. And so we've been developing work to try to encourage those employers in those sectors to work specifically with groups of young people of colour, particularly young Black men, who just really are interested in work and want the work. So we've been doing some of that. We did that prior to the pandemic. We will continue to do that as we come out. But also that stuff that I was saying around financial hardship, we are thinking about what we can do, despite me saying it would be really great to get my hands on the welfare budget. Doing what we can do locally to make sure that all those individuals who we know once furlough ends, and who we know have been severely impacted by the lockdown and the shutdown of sectors, who will need proper, good, clear advice to know how to maximise their incomes. We know that we've got local welfare assistance schemes. We know that there are local authorities that are doing really important work. So we're working with local authorities to try to maximise the advice that we can give to those individuals who need it. And then also making sure we're working with the third sector, who we know can help us to do that. And that's all about making sure that we can get to a place where, for me, in relation to race and ethnicity, that we don't have a labour market in which Black individuals, Black, Asian and minority individuals do not see themselves and do not think are places for them. That has to stop. That needs to change. And also we need to boost their incomes where we can. It is a fact that we have far too many Black, Asian, minority, ethnic and migrant groups in London on the very lowest incomes. And so we need to sort of work in conjunction with employers, with the advice sector, and also, I mean, on housing, our housing costs are incredibly high. So working with our housing teams to make sure that we are boosting incomes where we can and bringing down costs where we can to try to maximise those incomes. So, yeah.
A great note to finish on. My guest today has been Debbie Weeks-Bernard. Debbie, thanks very much for being City Talks. You've been an absolutely brilliant guest. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by Centre for Cities. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher by searching Centre for Cities. Please rate, review and subscribe if you liked what you heard. You can also follow the Centre on Twitter, at Centre for Cities, or like us on Facebook and LinkedIn for the latest updates on what the Centre is up to. If you have any comments on the episode or suggestions for topics we should cover in the future, we'd love to hear from you. Do tweet us or send an email to info@centreforcities.org. The music was from Palace Fires by Johnny Foreigner, used with permission, and all rights are reserved.